Well, as Betty told you, what I'm going to talk about is two books that are very familiar to everybody. Can all of you hear me? Is the sound all right? Two books that are very familiar to everybody. One of them is the Gita, and the other is Light on the Path. And I wonder, how many of you are aware that those two books are companion pieces, that they go together? Very good. All right, some of you are aware of that. And that's the point I want to emphasize tonight. In the course of talking about these books, I know some of you know them very well, some of you not so well, and so I'm going to fill in a little background information. I'm sorry, that will be old stuff to those of you who know it, but those who aren't so familiar with these books will need that information. The Gita is, in fact, part of a very small part of a very big book. It's part of the Hindu epic of the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata is one of the great books of the world. It's old and it's long. Now, nobody knows exactly how old it is, but we know how long it is. It fills 18 volumes, big-sized volumes, a full shelf of books. It's seven times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey put together, the two Greek epics. Although we don't know exactly how old the Mahabharata is in its present form, in its content, it's one of the oldest stories in the world. But in fact, it's also one of the newest. We don't usually think of the Mahabharata as a new story, but it is. There's an English playwright by the name of Peter Brooks who rather recently dramatized the Mahabharata. Have any of you seen any version of Peter Brooks's? Did you see the play, Joy?
No,
the movie?
The video.
Oh, good. It's been videoed. Lovely.
Video.
Three videos? Okay. He condensed the 18 volumes of the Mahabharata into three plays. They last a total of 9 hours in performance. 2 years ago, Adele, my wife, and I were in Perth, Australia on a theosophical tour, and we barely missed seeing the Peter Brooks dramatic version of the Mahabharata. It was being presented in an abandoned quarry on the outskirts of Perth. All three plays, one after another, beginning at sundown, running all night, and ending the next morning at dawn. Well, we thought about going, but there were some transportation problems, and then finally my wife, whom I always obey, told me, there's no point in your going to that quarry all night, you'll never stay awake. And of course, she's right. So we went to the play only during our sleep on the astral plane. And astral productions, although they've got less limitations on them than physical productions, lack some of the immediacy that comes with the here and now. However, the Peter Brooks play has been further abridged into a movie that runs approximately 3 hours long. It's been recently released in the United States. We saw it earlier this year in New York. If you get a chance to see the Peter Brooks Mahabharata, go see it. It doesn't seem like 3 hours. It really doesn't. It goes by very fast. It's well worth going to. So from 18 printed volumes to 9 hours on the stage to 3 hours on the screen, the movie contains the condensed essence of the great epic of the Mahabharata. And that's the way Peter Brooks conceived this story. And it's the way he presents it. Not, in fact, as an epic about events in an ancient land long ago, but as the timeless epic of the human family, of humanity. Peter Brooks's Mahabharata is the beginning of a story that hasn't ended. We're all still in it. The Brooks version starts with a young boy wandering through the deserted ruins of a building. The setting is rather surrealistic in feeling. It's like one of those paintings by the Italian artist Giorgio de Chirico. You perhaps have seen some of his paintings. He paints pictures of deserted streets, perhaps some archways, the edge of a building. You constantly get the feeling that somebody has just turned the corner of the building. There are no people in the paintings, right? But you always have the feeling somebody has just turned the corner out of sight, or that something mysterious, wonderful, and perhaps a little dangerous is just about to happen. That's the setting that Brooks uses. Well, the boy wanders through this scene, and at each turning, the viewer expects the boy to come upon something marvelous and exciting. And indeed, eventually he does. He comes upon an old man, a storyteller by the name of Vyasa. And Vyasa has been waiting for the young boy in order to tell the boy a story about himself. But the storyteller can't begin until he has a writer, a scribe, to take it all down in order that it can be preserved for future humanity. And just then, in comes the elephant god, the elephant-headed god, Ganesha, who is the god of writers, of scribes. And he takes his pen and paper out of his wallet and tells Vyasa to begin. And so he does. Vyasa begins to tell the boy the story of his past history, and Ganesha writes it down, and it is the Mahabharata. Now, this great epic, this story of humanity, is a poem about war. Out of the events of strife and battle, it makes poetry. Out of discord, it produces harmony. One very short passage in this great universal history of humanity is the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord's Song. A song sung in the middle of a battlefield on the eve of an apocalyptic clash of armies. The story behind this war and poem is very briefly this. I'm going to condense it just tremendously down to just a few words. There were two royal brothers, Pandu and Dhritarashtra. Pandu was king, but he was under a dreadful curse. And to escape the consequences of that curse, he resigned his crown and went into exile in the wilderness. Dhritarashtra, who was blind, became regent until his sons, or Pandu's, became of age and the succession to the throne could be settled. Now, Dhritarashtra, although he was blind, was not otherwise physically impaired. He had 100 sons, of whom the eldest was named Duryodhana, a name which might be somewhat freely translated as dirty fighter. Duryodhana was a quarrelsome, greedy, arrogant, dishonest, oafish bully with other compatible character traits. He naturally decided that the best person to be king was himself. Now, Pandu had 5 sons, Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, the middle boy, and a pair of charming twins, Nakula and Sahadeva. The 5 Pandu boys were golden lads, well-mannered, accomplished, brave, respectful, ethical, handsome, considerate, and very cooperative. Each of them had a special talent in which he outshone all other youths. Arjuna's talent was archery. No one could do more things with a bow and arrow than he could. Now, the 5 Pandu brothers also shared a wife, whose name was Draupadi. You may think it a little odd that the 5 brothers should have one wife, but let me tell you how it came about, because that also is very important and casts a lot of light on their character. It's much to their credit. One day, when Arjuna was out and about, just moseying around, he came across a party where there was a contest being held. King Drupada had decided that his very beautiful and very desirable daughter, Draupadi, should get married, but that she should marry no one except the best warrior in the world. So to identify a husband for his daughter, he set up a contest. the prize for which was to be his daughter's hand in marriage. The contest was in archery. When Arjuna discovered the contest, he decided, not having anything better to do at the time, that he might as well enter it. And of course, he handily won the contest, archery being his great skill, and also won the Princess Draupadi as bride. Now, being a good and dutiful son, before marrying Draupadi, what does a good, dutiful son do before marrying? He takes her home to meet Mama, right? Of course. When he arrived home, however, his mother, whose name was Kunti, was busy cooking supper. So all her attention was on the pots she was stirring. And when Arjuna came to the door, he said, "Mama, you'll never guess what I've won today." But Kunti didn't even look up. She just kept on stirring her pots and said, "That's very nice, dear. Only you must be sure to be sharing it equally with your brothers." Now, the problem was that Kunti was a truth speaker. She was famous for never saying anything false or wrong. And her every command had always been obeyed by her five sons without hesitation. They were such good boys. Whatever Kunti said was true and right, and they did it. What was spoken could not be unspoken. So what to do? If they ignored what Kunti had said, her sons would make a liar out of her, and they would be no better than their awful cousins, Duryodhana and his 99 obnoxious brothers. The five Pandu boys got together and discussed what they should do. Being dutiful, cooperative lads, they decided the only thing to do was to obey their mother. And so they all married Draupadi, and she became the loving and greatly beloved wife of all five Pandu boys, and they all lived happily ever after. Now, you will recognize that this episode is a cross between a fairy tale and a soap opera. In many ways, the Mahabharata is a great medieval Indian soap opera. I can say that with some confidence. I've been saying for some time, and a few years ago, I was talking on the Gita at the University of Florida in a lecture there, and in the audience was a Indian woman who is a scholar of the Gita. That's her specialty. And I came to that point, and I thought, oh, why not? So I said it. And I saw over the faces of many of my colleagues in the audience a little frown go. But I looked at the Indian scholar of the Gita, and she was going... Well, after all, why not? Human history itself is just a big soap opera. So why not? Actually, this episode has got some other things to it, which I'm not going to go into it. It does have an allegorical meaning, because there are five Pandu boys. Actually, they've got a sixth brother who is unknown to them. Draupadi, that makes how many? Seven. And seven is going to be principles, right? They are the seven principles. And Draupadi is that principle which is known as jiva, life, energy, power, that runs through all of the other principles, right, and vivifies them. So you've got an allegory working here underneath as well, but we'll just stick with the soap opera tonight. Okay, well, their cousins, led by Duryodhana, were a different lot altogether. Having decided that he should be king, Duryodhana plotted how he could cheat his cousins out of their rightful inheritance. And although each of the Pandus had a very great skill, the eldest, Yudhishthira, also had a very unfortunate weakness. He liked to gamble. And even worse, he gambled badly. He always lost. And so Duryodhana challenged Yudhishthira to a dice game. And just to be sure that it went his way, Duryodhana got his crooked uncle to play for him using loaded dice. Well, Yudhishthira just could not refuse the challenge to play. And his four brothers, although they all sensed that disaster was imminent, were too polite to demur. So the dice game began. At first, the stakes were just a few jewels and other such baubles. But as Yudhishthira lost throw after throw, the stakes got higher and higher. Finally, Yudhishthira gambled for the whole kingdom and lost it. And then he gambled for his and his brother's freedom, and he lost. And finally, he gambled for the beautiful Draupadi, their wife, and lost. Draupadi was sent for and dragged like a slave before Duryodhana and his 99 brothers. She was insulted and stripped of her garments and exposed in shame in front of her helpless husbands. Then and there, the five Pandu brothers swore a dreadful revenge on their cousin Duryodhana. The five Pandu brothers with Draupadi were sent into exile for 13 years. Duryodhana sent soldiers to find them, but they eluded their pursuers and returned to the kingdom to claim their inheritance at the end of the 13th year. But Duryodhana would give them nothing. They offered to split the kingdom with him, each taking half. But Duryodhana would give them nothing. They offered to be satisfied with only 5 villages, 1 for each of them. But Duryodhana would give them nothing. In the face of such intransigence, such greed, such deceit, nothing remained but for the 5 Pandu brothers to make war on their evil cousin, Duryodhana. So preparations began. Arjuna, on behalf of himself and his brothers, went to their childhood friend and relative, Krishna, the king of a nearby land, to ask for his help. And Duryodhana hurried to do the same. Krishna, when faced with a request from both sides, said, "What am I to do? You have both asked for help, and I am allied to both of you. How can I help one and not the other? But I cannot have the members of my army fighting against one another." "So," said Krishna, "here is what I will do. To one side I will give my whole army with all their equipment and supplies, and to the other side I will serve as an advisor, not a fighter, not a combatant, but an advisor. Now, which of you wants my army and which wants me?" "Now, let me get this straight," said Duryodhana. "One of us gets all your army without reservation, and you are not going to fight at all for the other side." "That's right," said Krishna. "Then," said Duryodhana, "I'll take your army, Krishna." "And I," said Arjuna, "will take you, Krishna." And so Krishna became Arjuna's charioteer, not fighting, but driving and guiding the great war chariot in which Arjuna rode and from which he shot arrows from his bow. And so the two sides assembled for battle on Kurukshetra, the ancestral field of both families. On the one side, the 5 Pandu brothers and their supporters and Krishna. On the other, Duryodhana, his 99 brothers, their common grandfather, and their common teacher. The battle was ready to begin, and this is the point at which the Bhagavad Gita begins. Arjuna asks Krishna to drive him to the center of the battlefield, and there at the center, Arjuna looks around him. He sees that the battle will result in relative slaying relative, student slaying teacher. He sees that the social order will be destroyed. He sees the dreadful karma that will inevitably flow from this action. Overcome by depression, Arjuna throws away his bow and arrow, right? His great talent, throws it away, slumps on the seat of his chariot and says, "I will not fight." The rest of the Gita, chapters 2 to 18, are Krishna's answer to Arjuna. But that long answer is also condensed in Light on the Path, written down by Mabel Collins. Light on the Path is a collection of short, pithy aphorisms or rules To them, various explanatory additional rules and comments have been added, and finally some explanatory notes, all organized into two sections or parts. What parallels the Gita most closely are the first six original aphorisms in the second section of the book, rules numbered Roman 2, 1 to 3, and 5 to 7, with their associated commentary. And I'd like to look at those rules with you a little bit now. But first, let's return to Arjuna's statement of despondency. He has said, "I will not fight." This is the statement that the rest of the Gita and a sizable portion of Light on the Path are about. What part of that statement should we pay most careful attention to? Well, you know, linguists say that every sentence can be divided into two parts. One part is called old information, and the other part is called new information. Normally, the old information is in the first part of the sentence, and the new information is in the second part of the sentence. Right. For example, I am telling you about... That's old information, because I'm doing it. You can see it. I'm not giving you anything really, right? I'm just setting the scene. Then I am telling you about what is going to happen. That's the new information. New information at the end, old at the beginning. Normally, we focus on what part of a sentence? The end. It's got the biggest stress. It's got the new information. That's where we go. That's what we look at. In Arjuna's statement, "I will not fight," the old information is, "I will." The new information is, "not fight." But in this case, if we focus on the new information and ignore the old, we are missing the important points. As it happens, the not fighting is really secondary. It's really trivial. The important part of Arjuna's statement is in the old information. And very old information it is. I will. I will. That's the important part of that statement. Who is the I that wills? Who is the warrior on this battlefield? Who decides? You know, there are certain great metaphors that have been used for life, for evolution. It's been called a journey. Can you think of any literary work in which life has been compared to a journey? Paradise Lost, of course, in which we have the journey of Dante through hell and purgatory and heaven. That's Divine Comedy. Paradise Lost as well. We have Adam and Eve journeying out of paradise in it. What I think, of course, is Chaucer's Canterbury Pilgrimage. Some of you may have read long ago, perhaps. Right? Life also, though, is compared sometimes to a sea voyage. Can you think of any works where it's... Crossing the Bar, sure, by Tennyson, Moby Dick, all sorts of them. That's a common metaphor, isn't it? The sea voyage. It's also been compared to a contest, an athletic contest. St. Paul did that. "I have run the race, I have finished the course," St. Paul said. Right? Athletic event. Shakespeare compared it to a dramatic performance, right? All the world's the stage and all the men and women in it merely players. They have their entrances and their exits, and one man, sorry, Betty, in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages, right? Okay, the dramatical metaphor. But in the Gita, life and evolution are compared to a battle, to a war, to a fight. But in the battle of life, who does the fighting? Who is the warrior? That's what Arjuna has to learn in the Gita. And that's the question Light on the Path addresses. I want to draw your attention first to the first three aphorisms in the second half of that book. They are, "Stand aside in the coming battle, and though thou fightest, be not thou the warrior." Stand aside in the coming battle. It's just what Arjuna wants to do. He wants to stand aside. But it goes on. "But though thou fightest, be not thou the warrior." Second aphorism, look for the warrior and let him fight in thee. Third aphorism, take his orders for battle and obey them. We are told to stand aside in the battle, and though we fight not to be the warrior, we are not to fight in, of, or for our personal selves. This is what the Gita calls nishkama karma. Action without consideration of personal benefit. Instead, we are to look for the warrior. That warrior is the one self within all our apparently separated selves. We are to take the orders of that self and to obey them. Light on the Path goes on in a little commentary to explain this. It says, obey him as though he were a general. Obey him not as though he were a general, but as though he were thyself, and his spoken words were the utterance of thy secret desires. For he is thyself, yet infinitely wiser and stronger than thyself. Look for him, else in the fever and hurry of the fight thou mayest pass him, and he will not know thee unless thou knowest him. He will not know thee unless thou knowest him. In the Mahatma letters, the Master K.H. told A.P. Sinnett, we cannot come into your world. You must come to ours. Light on the Path goes on. If thy cry meet his listening ear, then will he fight in thee and fill the dull void within. And if this is so, then canst thou go through the fight cool and unwearied, standing aside and letting him battle for thee. Then it will be impossible for thee to strike one blow amiss. But if thou look not for him, if thou pass him by, then there is no safeguard for thee. Thy brain will reel, thy heart will grow uncertain, and in the dust of the battlefield thy sight and senses will fail, and thou wilt not know thy friends from thy enemies. And that, of course, is the state Arjuna has found himself in. He's confused, his head is reeling, he doesn't know friends from enemies. It's also the state in which each of us finds ourselves. Finally, Light on the Path concludes this little commentary, he is thyself, yet thou art but finite and liable to error. He is eternal and is sure. He is eternal truth. When once he has entered thee and become thy warrior, he will never utterly desert thee. And at the day of the great peace, he will become one with thee. Well, there's another way of looking at these aphorisms from Light on the Path that's very important. They tell us to look for the warrior, but also that he is thyself. We might just as well have been told to look for the teacher in the school of life. Another metaphor, right? But of that teacher, we would also be told, he is thyself. So many people today want a teacher, long for a guru, seek a master. They want someone to tell them what truth is, to tell them what is good, to tell them what they should do. They want to turn their lives over to someone or something outside themselves. They want direction from a holy book or a holy man or woman. They want somebody else to be responsible for them. They want to stand aside in the coming battle. But what they don't understand is that the warrior they are to look for is not outside, but inside them. There is, ladies and gentlemen, no teacher at the head of the class. There is no guru in flowing white robes who will reveal the mysteries of the universe. There is no master whose footsteps we may follow in walking the path. As Krishnamurti said, truth is a pathless land, as the voice of the silence says, prepare thyself, for thou will have to travel on alone. The teacher can but point the way. As the master said in a letter to Annie Besant, this cant about masters must be put down. And I think by that he meant this reliance, this wanting to turn oneself over. There is no human teacher, there is no ghostly teacher on the higher planes whom we can rely on to do for us what only we can do for ourselves. And when we try to create a teacher to do for us what we can only do for ourselves, what do we do to that person? What did everybody in the land of Oz do to the poor wizard? They made him a humbug. If you ask someone else to do for you what they can't do, and only you can do. When we depend upon such a teacher, human or ghostly, we retard our own evolution, we create dissension, we lead others astray. We must look for the warrior, but look for him within, for that's the only place he can be found. Obey him not as though he were a general, but as though he were thyself, for he is thyself. And at the day of great peace, he will become one with thee. Our little separate selves will be enfolded into that one great unified self. Great. How do we do that? How do we look for the warrior? How do we let him fight in us? How do we reach the goal of the day of great peace when he will become one with us? The next group of aphorisms in Light on the Path answers those questions. These aphorisms, these three aphorisms, are the following. Listen to the song of life. Store in your memory the melody you hear. Learn from it the lesson of harmony. Now, the Mahabharata is about a war, a great war in which we are all soldiers, in which we are all fighting. But miracle of miracles, marvel of marvels, wonder of wonders, out of that war comes not cannon shots and explosions, not groans and cries, but a song, the song of life, the song of the Blessed One. As the commentary on Light on the Path says, having heard that song, you can stand upright now, firm as a rock amid the turmoil, obeying the warrior who is thyself and thy king. Well, how does one do this? How does one listen to the song of life? How do we hear its melody? How do we learn the lesson of harmony? How do you explain to someone who has never heard Mozart the glorious song of the magic flute? How do you explain to one who has never heard Handel the magnificent melody of the Messiah? How do you explain to someone who has never heard Bach what harmony is? You cannot learn until you have heard. You cannot hear until you have listened. We have, say the masters, only one word for those who would reach us. And that one word is try. Listen to the song of life and you will hear it. And when you have heard it, when we have heard it, we discover something astounding. The song of life does not drown out the cry of battle. The song of life does not clash with the cry of battle. The song of life does not blend with the cry of battle. The song of life is the cry of battle. The harmony is not in the notes. It is in the listening. When we hear the song we have listened for, we discover that it is the cry we thought before was only the noise of pain. The deaf think it is a cry. It is not. It is a song. When Dorothy gave the founder's lecture on the first night of convention, she included in it a quotation from Krishnamurti, which is saying exactly this thing, Let me repeat it for you from Dorothy's lecture. This is how to do it. This is how to hear the song of life. Sit very quietly and be still. Not only physically, not only in your body, but also in your mind. Be very still. And in that stillness, attend. Watch. Listen. Look. Listen first to the things outside you. Then listen to what is going on in the mind. Then in that silence, you will see that the outside sound and the inside sound are the same. The cry of battle is the song of life. They are the same. This is what is written in the Hall of Learning. Stand aside in the coming battle, and though thou fightest, be not thou the warrior. Listen to the song of life. Look for the warrior and let him fight in thee. Store in your memory the melody you hear. Take his orders for battle and obey them. Learn from it the lesson of harmony. Human life is an epic, the story of a great battle, the Mahabharata, in which we are all fighting. But the Mahabharata is not really a battle. It's a song. And at the heart of this poem, this song, is the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Blessed One, the song of life. We are all singing that song. We are all fighting, but we are not the warrior. We are singing, but we are not the song. Look for the warrior. Listen to the song of life. The battle and the song are one. The warrior fights in us. The song sings itself through us. We must take his orders and obey them. We must learn from it the lesson of harmony. Without is the battle and the cries of battle. Within is the warrior and the harmony. Look for the warrior. Listen to the song of life. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.